Welcome to another episode of the IQ and Human Intelligence podcast from Riot IQ. Today, my guest is Dr. Damian Morris, an affiliate researcher with King's College London. We're here to talk about his three-part series called Behavioral Genetics and Human Agency, how selectively deterministic theories of free will drive unwarranted opposition to behavioral genetic research and undermine our moral and legal conventions. These articles are published in the journal Twin Research in Human Genetics, and they are a fascinating discussion about the philosophy of genetics and IQ and other issues and how they impact real life debates about legal responsibility, about what we should research and why, and about how society should handle these issues. So thanks for coming with us on the episode, Damian. I appreciate you.
Pleasure to be here, Russell.
Excellent. Now, before we dive into this meaty discussion that you have, tell me about your background as a scholar.
I had a slightly meandering pathway to where I am in behavioral genetics today. My undergraduate training was in the humanities, liberal arts, I guess you'd say, in America. I did my undergrad degree at Melbourne University and majored in philosophy and social theory, and took a few extra credits to get a bonus major in English literature. So I was a humanities, you know, a word cell par excellence, very far from being a scientist, very far from STEM. And after doing my degree, I did a teaching qualification. I worked in the education sector for a few years, first as a secondary school teacher, later in environmental education programs. And from there, I went into climate change policy and advocacy for a while, working first for a climate change think tank called Sandbag, which was focused very much on environmental reform of the European carbon market. And it was here that I kind of got my first taste of quantitative analysis. We did a lot of number crunching to work out, you know, how oversupplied the European carbon market was, how long, different industrial sectors will be oversupplied carbon allowances under different emission scenarios and stuff like that. And I learned the power of data to tell a really powerful story and cut through a lot of noise, a lot of verbal arguments that weren't based in any objective reality. So that gave me my first kind of taste of kind of quantitative thinking. After Sandbag, I broke out my own and started my own consultancy, which I'm still the director of, Future Proof Consulting, and did very similar work. But after about 10 years of working on climate change policy between Sandbag and Future Proof, I basically made myself obsolete. I mean, all of the policy recommendations that we had been campaigning for a decade had basically been implemented, and my expertise was kind of not so useful anymore, and I'd also given
good for society, bad for you personally.
Yeah, so I could have at that point shifted sideways into some other role in the environment sector, but I thought I'd kind of given 10 years of my life to the issue, started looking around for other challenges, and at that point Robert Plowman and Catherine Asbury were in the news a lot because they'd just come out with a book called G is for Genes about the genetics of education. And I just happened to pick this book up and I read it and I was just blown away. I felt it completely challenged a whole lot of prejudices that I'd taken from my undergrad education. It basically introduced me to this notion that's very familiar to behavioral geneticists, the second law of behavioral genetics, which is the surprising and controversial finding that in behavior genetic studies, the influence of genes is almost always found to be larger than the influence of the environmental influence of family background.
Yep.
And it brought this up in this socially significant domain of educational achievement and educational attainment. I just felt like the scales fell from my eyes, and all these things that I'd been that I'd been bombarded with and taken for granted, reading The Guardian, The Financial Times, The Economist, about social mobility and the causes of the environmental causes of inequality, had to be radically revised. That it kind of shook my worldview. to its foundation.
It is true that behavioral genetics does end up causing us to sacrifice a lot of sacred cows. Yeah. A lot of people have had similar experiences where they discover behavioral genetics findings and, oh my gosh, what I believed about education or criminal behavior or social mobility ends up being seriously questioned, is sometimes completely thrown away because of the behavioral genetics research. So I'm not surprised that you had this revolutionary experience reading a book called G is for Genes.
Yeah. So yeah, I finished that and I was just so blown away by it. I immediately went out and bought the behavioral genetics textbook that Robert Plomin had written. And I just read that cover to cover. And I knew by the time I was halfway through it that I had to study this, that it was the next big challenge, the next big, you know, thing that I wanted to focus on. And it just so happened that Robert Plomin was teaching just up the road from where I lived. He was based at King's College London's Social Genetic and Developmental Psychiatry Centre. And they were running a master's course, which I, you know, enrolled in, and with a view to convincing them to put me in a PhD program, which fortunately panned out. And here we are.
Wow. That's what I like about it is that when I ask people this question, very few people start off wanting to be intelligence research. Everyone comes into this field from somewhere else. You're the first humanities person I've had on the podcast who came in from the humanities, but it's really amazing because behavioral genetics and intelligence research, both of them touch so many applied areas of life that we end up pulling people in from humanities, from biology, from genetics, from pure psychology, in my case, from education. So it's, I do like hearing how on the one hand, everyone's story is unique. On the other hand, there is this running theme with our guests of, well, I started doing X and I ended up doing this instead. Here I am on a podcast about it. So it's a very good background. And now that I know that you have this humanities background, I'm now not surprised that you wrote a heavily philosophical 3-article series. Can you give me a short summary of what your argument is in these articles?
Yeah, I'll give it a shot. So the main argument of the piece is that that essentially a confused theory of free will is causing needless anxiety about the prospect of substantial genetic causation of individual differences in human behavior. And that this theory is it risks biasing researchers again, not just researchers but other stakeholders, against any evidence that suggests that these influences are substantial, and I call this the theory of free will by subtraction.
What do you mean by free will by subtraction?
I think the social sciences is where you get the clearest sense of how this works. So there's kind of a, you know, the logic of free will by subtraction is kind of running in the background through a lot of social science papers and a lot of the ways that people report about social science findings. And it's this kind of ubiquitous logic that we are victims of circumstance to the extent that some statistical predictor of our behavior, some environmental variable like our parent socioeconomic status, can predict our outcomes and behavior. And there's a kind of logic to it, like, you know, we had no role in choosing our parents. How can we be held responsible for the effects of, you know, when you can trace the causes of your behavior to something you obviously didn't have control over?
Yeah, it's not your fault you were born in the bad neighborhood, so Right. Maybe you're less responsible for your lower school achievement or whatever other outcomes that predicts.
Yeah. But when you start to look at it closely and you start to think about the logic of it, the problem of this is that the way people think about it is that any part of your behavior that isn't attributed to these circumstances that are outside of your control is considered to be inside your control. So you have this sense that, you know, that the measured causes of your behavior are kind of statistical intrusions on an otherwise free your otherwise free behavior. So you end up with this implicit theory that it's very rarely articulated as this, but the implicit logic is that we can mathematically quantify the free will you have for any behavioral trait as the residual variation in that behavior that can't be predicted by a measured set of statistical variables.
So what you're saying is we start off with the behavior, and then we say, okay, well, here's how much of it is explained by this background variable. Here's how much is explained by that one and that one. And then whatever we have left over, that's where your free will lives.
Yeah. And as I said, like most of the time, this is just kind of running in the background. It kind of rears its head in the way policy recommendations are formed, and they're just kind of hints of it in the way a lot of social science papers are written. I focus my piece on two behavioral geneticists who make that into an explicit theory of free will. And I think they've really done us a service, actually, by laying out this theory, thinking it through to its logical conclusion and kind of laying it on the table so we can discuss it and kind of pick over it.
I agree, because when we have implied consequences or implicit ideas swimming below the surface, they're harder to interrogate.
Yeah.
But when someone brings it out into the open and says, hey, I think that free will is in this portion where we can't explain where the behavior comes from, now we can talk about it and engage with it better.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, if you go in guns blazing at this kind of hinted idea, people just can just accuse you of misreading them. Whereas, you know, if someone sympathetically articulates that philosophy better than someone has ever articulated it before, you know, it gives you a clearer handle with which to engage with this question.
Yeah, if someone explicitly states this free will by subtraction viewpoint, it's a lot harder for them to later accuse you of misunderstanding them, or they can't say, well, I didn't say that, when you're quoting them in the paper.
Yeah.
So that makes sense. That makes sense.
That's what we have.
So,
but there's a key part to this, if I could just go one step further.
Yes, please.
The key missing ingredient here is, you know, how is human agency supposed to arise at all under a secular materialist view in which all human behavior is assumed to ultimately have antecedent causes? Yes, we've identified some of them, and we haven't identified others, but you know, if we're going to say causation, the causes that we know about infringe on and remove responsibility, what's going on with the rest of human behavior? If we think all human behavior is caused, which is what most secular materialists believe, then not knowing about the causes of behavior cannot make you free.
Ironically, it's almost an Orwellian ignorance is what makes you free. Well, we found these causes of behavior, and what we don't know about is what makes you free. And as long as we're ignorant, we could still have free will. But that doesn't make sense. Our free will can't rely on our ignorance. And I'm not sure I like a theory that requires ignorance to function.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the knock-on effects of this theory is there's kind of two important repercussions from it. One, if you think that genetic and environmental causation infringes on human agency, you'll be more resistant to the prospect that science can explain more of human behavior. And this becomes, you know, it makes you resistant to environmental as well as genetic causes of human behavior, but it makes, you know, because of what we already talked about earlier, the second law of behavior genetics, genetic influences are such a large contributor to most behavioral traits that we look at, that it's a really large chunk of the behavioral variation. You know, most of the pie is taken away once you account for genetics and shared environmental influences. This can prompt hostility towards genetic, you know, scientific explanation of human behavior, and especially genetic explanation of human behavior, because it just leaves so little free will left, so little space for us left to have, you know, to be in control of ourselves and responsible for our own behavior, and people don't like that. And I sympathize with them not liking that prospect. The second potential implication from that is if you accept that genetic causes are substantial, And you believe that genetic and environmental influences make us non-responsible for our actions, it can potentially, if you don't think people are responsible for their behavior, you have more, it's more legitimate for you to control them. If they're not responsible for themselves, you know, you can, you have more, more of a justification to enact coercive policies and paternalistic policies to control these people who are effectively, they're like minors. Then they're not fully in control of their of their behavior.
You're right. We make that argument with children, and I have children of my own. I'm responsible for them because they are not fully responsible. They're not fully capable of making decisions. This free will by subtraction theory, from my understanding of what you're saying, is that one of the consequences is that, well, if all of us have, if we keep discovering causes of behavior, then the amount of free will people have shrinks more and more and more. And then functionally, they become like children or other people with diminished capacity, dementia patients, etc. Ah, now someone else can make decisions on their behalf. And I think I see the danger in that of lessening freedom, of lessening personal responsibility. And I'm sure we'll dive into that more later. I do want to ask you, why was this published as three separate articles back to back to back? Why not as one? What's the story behind that with the publisher?
Yeah, the short answer is because it was just too long to be published as a single article in most of the outlets that would reach the kind of audiences that I wanted to reach. This was originally a chapter of my PhD thesis, and when I went to tackle this, I knew that there were a set of problems that I had a kind of an idea of where I was going to, you know, go in addressing them, but I kind of knew it needed as long as it needed for me to address all the dimensions of these problems and these issues that I wanted to talk about. And, you know, fortunately, I had two very sympathetic supervisors who indulged my eccentric pursuit to address these questions, these kind of philosophical questions about behavioral genetics, you know, separate to the empirical papers that were in my PhD. But yes, you know, once I had completed, you know, what I hope is a fairly polished, you know, piece that, you know, that took me quite some trouble to organize into its current form, I was then faced with this dilemma. Okay, it's longer than the long form discussion pieces that you tend to see in my field and our field, you know, places like Perspectives in Psychological Science or Behavioral and Brain Sciences. Which tend to max out at about 10,000 words, but it was kind of a little bit on the short side to be a book.
You're in a twilight zone, too short for a book, too long for a traditional article. Where do I put this?
Yeah. So I started to be somewhat dismayed thinking, you know, after doing all this work, I was going to have to either slice and dice it and cut it up into this kind of digestible little chunks or embark on this next big, you know, I've got some follow-up work that I'd like to do that's thematically related and, you know, build it into a longer piece and publish it as a book. But as it happened, you know, I it was accepted into Twin Research and Human Genetics, and they kindly offered to publish it across three issues just so it didn't dominate and stretch the boundaries of a normal length issue, and to make it share, you know, so it could share real estate with other articles across
a few pieces. Well, I guess maybe also three times as many citations too, or something, you know, who knows, there might be other advantages, but it does make it more bite-sized. I hope the length doesn't discourage anyone, because it is interesting, but an advantage is, okay, you know, I personally read each part one per day over the course of 3 days, and you know, if you're going to dive into some philosophy, it's nice to have it in regular, evenly sized doses, I should say. I just hadn't seen a unified article like this ever cut up into three, but it works, and I like it in its presentation.
I'm glad you say that. Yeah, one of my concerns about the piece is that its length is daunting, and that I think it's putting a few people off. But Yeah, I think, you know, it's basically, it's published in three parts, and it also, you know, that all three parts, you know, together are divided into 10 sections, and those are about as long as a Substack news article, or, you know, a 4 or 5 page discussion piece. And I think, you know, if people can just take, you know, one chunk at a time, but, you know, you can, by doing a piece this length, you can build something that's bigger than the sum of its parts.
That's true.
Or at least that's what I'm attempting to do.
No, I think you succeed in that, because honestly, any of those 10 subsections are interesting in and of themselves. And they could have made a good commentary. Having the whole series there in a unified whole really does help you see the big picture of how free will and philosophy relate to genetics, relate to environment, relate to these practical things. And I think you succeed in that. And otherwise, I wouldn't want to talk about the articles with you here on the podcast. I do want to ask you, you know, I'm a scientist. I work with data. I'm interested in stats and results. Why should someone like me care about the philosophy of behavioral genetics, or the philosophy of areas like behavior, psychology, IQ? Why can't we just collect our data and do our science? Why should we do this navel gazing about free will and things like this?
Yeah, no, it's a good point, and I bring it up. You know, I've given a couple of presentations on this to scientist audiences, and the piece itself starts off with a quote that I start the presentations with, which is a quote from John Maynard Keynes, where he basically says, you know, a lot, you know, we are unconsciously, I'm paraphrasing, we don't necessarily study philosophy, we don't necessarily think philosophy, but philosophy is impacting how we think about a lot of ideas all the time. And it's just, yeah, it's part of the kind of the ether that we breathe, that it can affect some quite important aspects of how we do science. As I touched on, you know, before, we can, you know, there are these two quite significant implications from this free will by subtraction view that's running in the background. I think just, you know, more generally, this question about what secular scientific explanation of human behavior means for society is about the biggest and most important question that you can ask. I you know, this is the, these are the questions that you know, led to Dostoevsky and Nietzsche talking about the death of God, and you know, wondering how morality could be put, if it could be put at all, on an alternative foundation. You know, now, and this is all responding to things like, you know, Darwin's Origin of Species coming out, and the popularization of findings about, you know, brain anatomy causing, you know, differences in behavior and ability. So, you know, I would argue that we are still wrestling with the same questions that Dostoevsky and Nietzsche were talking about then. And, you know, I think they, you know, they laid out fundamentally what the challenges are, and we've been kind of still trying to work out what the answers to those questions are. And this is kind of my shot at it. Like, you know, I'm not proposing that I've solved all these questions myself, but I, you know, it's me kind of assembling, you know, lots of quotes and the, you know, the best parts and the best arguments of people I think have given a pretty good answer to these questions.
Okay, so I want to follow up with this, and if we understand this, it comes down to how we see human beings as agents, as being able to make decisions. I also understand that, you know, from a scientific point of view, it also has implications for what it is we're studying. If I see humans as automatons controlled by their genes, their environment, their circumstances, I'm going to study that automaton much more differently than if I understand that human as having a free will, having agency, having the ability to act, maybe within the constraints of its genes, because every organism is constrained by its genes. I can't fly. But I see there are big implications for scientists, and I see there are big implications for everyday people of whether you are convinced by a deterministic biological determinism, free will is limited or non-existent, versus, okay, we could carve out a space for this without relying on our ignorance. How would you respond to that?
Yeah, I suppose I don't see it as being such a factor as to how people go about doing day-to-day empirical science. Mm-hmm. If scientists were truly dispassionate and truly lived up to like what my ideal of a scientist is, which is, you know, follow the truth where it leads, and especially follow the truth where it leads on controversial subjects, because we want the facts, we don't want to know the facts there more than anywhere else. But it does affect science to the extent that scientists let some kind of ideological or even kind of semi-theological concerns about free will impact what kind of results they find are acceptable. If it stops certain research questions being asked, because we don't know what we might find if we look there, we might find that there's, you know, or if it creates an asymmetry in how different results are received, that, you know, it's great news if a study comes out that shows weak genetic influence and we broadcast that, you know, through the scientific community, and if anything comes out that suggests the opposite, it doesn't get as much traction. Mm-hmm. So there's these kind of, you know, I don't think it's strictly, you know, in an ideal sense, it's not, it shouldn't really affect one way or the other how science is performed, but scientists are humans and they come with all of the same, you know, prejudices and weaknesses and that other people in other segments of society have. But between those fears about what, you know, fears or concerns about what certain results mean, you know, that can shape the direction of empirical research. And then there's the question of how, you know, there is a lot of extra scientific interpretation of what results mean that's published in scientific papers. And, you know, you have quite far-reaching conclusions drawn about what we should do about inequalities that have a genetic or environmental basis. Now, all of this is really philosophy that's being published in scientific papers. Sometimes not. You know, when Catherine Page Harden wrote The Genetic Lottery, that was a book, and she can explore these philosophical issues in you know, at her leisure. But, you know, mm-hmm. it's actually surprising how much of social science and behavioral genetics has, you know, quite controversial policy recommendations that have an essential, you know, have some kind of notion of free will or some notion of political philosophy running in the background that a lot of readers and a lot of policymakers would disagree with.
Interesting. No, I think you're right. And I do think particularly damning from a scientific perspective is if we do the study, accepted methodology, if we get these results, we're happy about it. If we get these results, we're not. And maybe we should treat the results we don't like differently. And that doesn't make sense to me. I find that a little disturbing. We see that in intelligence research. You know, there are results that become politically or socially controversial. But when we find results that go against that, I think, for example, of gene-environment interactions. When there are studies showing that, yes, there's a strong interaction between SES and genetics, so that in lower SES homes, we find a weaker genetic influence, but in higher SES homes, we find a stronger genetic influence. That's really strongly hailed. Oh, look, it's not all because of genes. Look at how important SES is. But then when that research doesn't replicate, we don't react the same way, and we don't cite those failed replications that show equally strong genetic influence in low and high SES families. We don't hail that as being, hooray, it's consistent. And I say we as a collective, we as society or a field. So I think there is that asymmetry, not just in behavioral genetics, but in other areas. And you give some examples of people hailing low genetic influence on some behaviors, and then with this very same methodology, that being threatened by high genetic influence on others. And no, we should just let the chips fall where they may and let the data take us where it does.
Yeah. And I think there are always going to be these kind of animal spirits things where, for whatever reason, people are more fond of certain findings are more popular than others, and it can go along all kinds of different dimensions that happens. I think the most problematic kind, I think that problem will always be with us as long as there are human beings doing science, and ChatGPT isn't doing it for us. the bigger problem, which I touch on a little bit in the first section of the paper, is that there is occasionally pressure on what are considered socially controversial traits, which I would say are socially significant traits, mm-hmm. that even asking the question of what are the genes associated with this behavior, how large are the genetic influences on this behavior, have become off limits. And we've just very recently, without naming any names, it's been a very important study looking at one of the best type of molecular genetic studies you can do, estimating the heritability of a whole bunch of different traits using one of the latest and best methods of estimating the heritability. And the data owners refuse to perform the analyses on cognitive traits and educational attainment. So we just don't have the answer to that question because it's considered too sensitive. And I think that's a really interesting question. Whatever side of the debate you're on, mm-hmm. you want to know the answer. but we're going to have to wait a bit longer to know the answer to that question.
Yeah, I don't know if we could do any mind reading for them, but assuming they operate by this free will by subtraction theory, then ignorance is bliss in that viewpoint. I don't agree with that as a scientist. I think get all the data out there, do all the analyses. But I can see how underlying philosophical orientations, underlying belief in certain implications but not others, finding these implications as good, these as bad, can lead you to start saying, see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil, I'm not going to analyze my data that way. That's a little scary if you really believe in free inquiry. And so I think grappling with these ideas philosophically force us to then say, what consequences are there for science, for society, et cetera? So that's one of the reasons why I like the series of articles you have. I do think that, and I love this in the second one, I'm going to show it on my tablet, this diagram. I referred to it quite a few times as I was reading it, but it really does, in one image, boil down a lot of the debates. You make an argument that there are three types, there's three positions regarding free will and determinism. They're called libertarianism, compatibilism, and free will skepticism. Can you explain each of these positions for me, and then I'll have some follow-ups for you?
Yeah, sure. Let me get into it. I can give the caveats afterward. Compatibilism essentially holds that personal responsibility and moral desert are fully compatible with a deterministic universe in which causation reigns and history.
And what do you mean by moral desert?
People deserve punishment, for example.
Ah, okay.
Or deserve praise for their actions.
Got it.
Yeah. That all this is compatible with a universe where causation reigns and history was always going to unfold the way it did ever since the moment of the Big Bang, and for them, the key question in deciding whether someone's responsible for their actions isn't whether their behavior has previous causes, because all human behavior has previous causes. It's whether they could have acted differently if they really wanted to do so. If someone stuck a gun to their head in the same situation, could they have done something different? No one did stick a gun to their head, so they didn't. But if someone did, could they have done something different? So that's the essential principle on which, you know, responsibility and personal control of your behavior is construed in compatibilism.
So the compatibilists would say, yes, there are genetic and environmental causes, but we are still personally responsible for our behavior, because if we could rewind the tape of life and put you in that situation again, you could have behaved differently, either better or worse than what you did. And so we should praise or punish you according to what you deserve. Is that correct?
There's a slight wrinkle in how you've presented it back. Unfortunately, if you live in a deterministic universe, if you rewind the universe and play it again, people will always do exactly the same thing, because we're all caused and the same causes are happening. And it's a good example, because it's actually a thought experiment that trips a lot of people up. So compatibilists don't believe that you put in, if you're in exactly the same in precisely the same circumstances, that you will ever do anything except what you did. But they argue that the notion of responsibility doesn't hinge on that; that it hinges on not what causation forced you to do, but if you were presented with stronger incentives in a different direction, could you have acted differently?
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Got. Hence the gun
to your head.
Okay. I might not have robbed the bank, but someone had a gun to my head, and if I wanted to survive, then I would rob the bank, give them the money, and then once I'm safe, try to turn them in.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay, I see. Okay, that makes better sense than rewinding the tape.
This actually comes up, you know, we could go on a detour down this, but, you know, this comes... People often talk about things like the heritability of BMI or, you know, body weight, meaning you have less control of your behavior because, you know, it's got quite high heritability. And it's true that, you know, you'll have a different society. You'll have more, you know, different impulses about how much food you eat based on your genetics. But do you have free will? If someone put a gun to your head every day and said, if you eat, you know, I'm standing here with a gun, if you eat more than 2,000 calories a day, you're going to get it. Or, you know, here's your dog, I'm going to shoot your dog, or something like that. You know, it would change your behavior. You do have other options. But yeah, so that's kind of some of the nuances around compatibilism.
What about this idea of libertarianism?
Yeah, so libertarianism is... There's kind of compatibilism falls under one thing, and then there are a couple of different positions that fall under the category of incompatibilism. And incompatibilists say that because insofar as behavior is caused, you cannot be held responsible for it. So, you know, the position I laid out at the beginning, the free will by subtraction position, that is an incompatibilist position, because to the extent that we know the causes of your behavior, you can't be responsible. Libertarian incompatibilists subscribe to that. You know, if we can identify, you know, if there are causes for your behavior, you aren't responsible for them. But the interesting thing about libertarians is they say not all of human behavior is caused. There, you know, so free will by subtraction is a kind of libertarian incompatibilism. If human behavior is caused, you can't be responsible for it. But there are some sliver of human behavior, some escape hatches, where our behavior is uncaused. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, the traditional notion of this is the kind of religious notion that you have an immaterial soul that can miraculously make decisions, that the history of the planet was pushing everything in one direction, but because you have an immaterial and immortal soul that isn't bound by the laws of physics and the laws of nature, you can veer, you can zig instead of zagging. And you know, this is the, you know, essentially, you know, there are versions of this that are traditional kind of religious conceptions of free will, which take it that, you know, some of our behavior is caused by the physical will, but where it really matters, we can depart from that, or at least, you know, there is a subset of human behavior we can depart from that on. I should say, though, there are religious people who are compatibilists, and there are religious people that are also free will skeptics or incompatibilists, as we'll get onto in a moment. So That's the third. I don't know if you had anything else you wanted to ask about libertarian and compatibilism, or I'll jump
on. No, it makes sense. And saying how this free will by subtraction, which we've already explored, is a flavor of libertarianism, I think makes sense. And having the idea of, in some religious traditions, yes, you might be influenced by your past, but you are still free to choose good over evil.
Yeah.
Because you have a soul. That's another place where we've carved out, I like the escape hatch. We've carved out an escape hatch where we can say, all right, we still recognize personal responsibility because you do have some of that free will, but we also recognize that sometimes things aren't your fault. And that's libertarianism in a religious tradition, but the free will by subtraction is libertarianism in a secular position. Well, we don't know why you behaved that way. We haven't found it as a predictor of your behavior. Therefore, it must be your free will. Yeah. So I see them both as different flavors. I think having two examples of libertarianism helps me out.
Yeah.
What about the third one, of free will skepticism?
Yeah, I just add one comment before I jump.
Yes, please.
What was I going to say? Yeah, I think it's there are versions of libertarianism that I think are quite sophisticated and give you quite a lot of wiggle room. And I think, you know, there are religious versions of libertarianism where it's like it doesn't matter what the causal past was. You know, in any decision that morally matters, you are responsible for it. And you know, but that is, yeah. And also it has this kind of religious and supernatural backing to it. Mm-hmm. So I think, yeah, it's nice to draw this distinction. Now, you know, sometimes in the piece I call free will by subtraction secular libertarianism, to, you know, cause it's not religious in the world. It's subscribed to by people who declare they're not religious. But sometimes, you know, touching on something else you just said, I also call it epistemic libertarianism, which is this idea that, like, if we don't know the causes of your behavior, you're free. So these are all ways of describing this concept of that I've nicknamed free will by subtraction as well. Mm-hmm. But then we, you know, the last category is free will skepticism, and you know that's kind of it's there on the name of the tin. You know, like libertarian incompatibilists, they see, you know, human responsibility, personal responsibility, human agency is incompatible with the antecedent causation of human behavior. But unlike the libertarian incompatibilists, they see that all human behavior is caused. So, you know, both the compatibilists who believe in free will and the hard incompatibilist free will skeptics who don't believe in free will, they both agree that all of human behavior is caused. They just disagree on this question of whether causation makes responsibility impossible.
Got it. So in the for the free will skeptics, they agree that all behavior has these precursors, these antecedents that can cause, but they also say, hey, when we know the causes, or whether we don't know the causes, that excuses you. And so that's where you get for example, the sentencing phase of a criminal trial. Well, he had an abusive childhood. He had this depressing circumstance. He was addicted to drugs. Because we had these prior antecedents that caused his behavior, he's not responsible. Yeah. Am I correct in understanding that free will skepticism?
Well, actually, no. That's sorry.
I've never been wrong so many times in an episode. This is great. I'm learning a lot here.
Strictly, that's libertarian incompatibilism, because for, you know, for a free will skeptic, no one is responsible for anything, and there's no, you know, it doesn't matter whether you know the causes or don't know the causes. You know, if I plan to kill somebody, and you know, I plotted it for weeks, and I tracked them down, and then I killed them, I'm still not responsible for that. You know, I had a perfectly great childhood, everything else. I'm still not responsible for that under free will skepticism, because, you know, ever since the Big Bang, everyone was always determined to do what they were going to do. And because of that, no one can be held accountable for everything. We're all just, all, you know, everything's just happening to all of us. It's all predetermined. And we can't escape that. And because we can't escape it, we can't be held responsible for it. So the constant appeals to measured sources of environmental disadvantage and abuse and all these things that get brought up in courtroom dramas and increasingly get brought up in actual courtrooms. That is a libertarian. There's a libertarian incompatibilist free will by subtraction position that, you know, you are responsible for your behavior, but because some of your behavior was caused, that's an excuse. To the extent that they're appealing to causation as an excuse, they're definitely libertarian incompatibilists, or because
the free will skeptics say, in contrast, we're just a domino in the line that was pushed with the Big Bang, and there's nothing we can do about it. We can't get out of the way of the domino in front of us anymore, you know, that the dominoes themselves can't. So, okay, yeah. I see it. I'm still going to refer to the cheat sheet every now and then.
Please do. Sure, I was quite proud of that diagram. I'm glad you spontaneously brought it up.
Yeah, I'll ask our editor to also put the diagram up so that people can see on the screen, not just on my tablet, flashed at the camera. So, you know, we have these three viewpoints: the compatibilism, the libertarianism, the free will skepticism. You know, which of these three positions do you think is best for allowing us to preserve our ideas about personal responsibility while also allowing social science and genetic science to flourish?
Yeah, good question. I think it's pretty evident from what I just said about free will skepticism that it doesn't, you know, it annihilates responsibility, it annihilates desert, praiseworthiness, blameworthiness. All of these concepts go out the window. You can have some kind of clever, kind of three-dimensional chess ways of reconstructing something like responsibility based on constructing incentives in a kind of consequentialist viewpoint of trying to maximize good outcomes versus, you know, bad outcomes. But it's, you know, it becomes quite complicated to do that. I would, you know, there are some versions of libertarianism that I, you know, that I think can be compatible with conducting behavioral science and with our legal systems and our moral, you know, our moral intuitions. And, you know, that's kind of proven by the fact that we had, you know, essentially a religious model of human agency going around for going on, you know, 1,000 years or so, and it managed that pretty well. But it does face this challenge that, you know, if you have an idea, if you have that kind of religious idea of libertarianism we discussed before, where it's, you know, on any morally important decision, you have this miraculous power to break the chains of causation, I think that can get you a long way. But fundamentally, I think libertarian incompatibilism will always feel challenged by this evidence that we can see. People who have certain sets of genes, people who have certain sets of environmental exposures tend to turn out this way rather than that way. And that will, you know, that has the danger of, you know, this kind of dog ate my homework attitude to criminal sentencing. You know, you have this idea that people are not fully responsible for their actions and you know, I think this idea that you're only 50% responsible for murder because, you know, genetic and environmental influences explain the other 50%. I'm just kind of pulling a figure out of my head there. Yeah. I think it has all kinds of, you know, dangerous side effects that we want to avoid. And you know, holding that aside, I just don't think it's valid.
I think you're right. And especially if we do end up having this secular libertarianism view of, well, you're old and responsible for what we can't identify causes for. You start getting into uncomfortable positions like sentencing people differently for the same crime. You know, if you and I go out and we rob a bank together and we are equally culpable, I shouldn't say that because culpability and fault vary, but we did the exact same, you know, it was a 50-50 split who did each action. But if I was beaten as a child and I was addicted to drugs and maybe I got some bad genes in there, then I might end up receiving a lighter sentence than you, who might have had a utopian childhood. And that sort of clashes against people's views of fairness. Because if two people both did half the crime, shouldn't they both be punished equally?
Yes. It gets you directly into inequality under the law. And, you know, I go into this in more detail in Section 9, which addresses, you know, criminal responsibility specifically, and talks about, you know, some ideas from Paige Harden and David Eagleman and Adrian Raine, who've all written some great stuff on this material, even though I have different views to them. But, you know, one of the things, it's even more stark than what you say, Russ, because if a man and a woman commit the same crime, and because there, you can predict men commit crimes more, you know, just having a Y chromosome. And then, you know, what is the policy reaction to that? Do we sentence men more lightly? Do you have diminished responsibility because, oh, poor me, I have a Y chromosome, I can't control my bank robbing impulses,
my aggression,
or, you know, whatever it is, or, you know, depending on the crime? Or is it, you know, or is it the other way? Is it, you know, when the man and the woman, you know, go and get sentenced for the same crime, because the man is a higher risk to society, does he get a longer sentence for exactly the same crime? So, you know, it's this kind of two-edged sword, whichever way you apply this kind of logic. But it does lead to this fundamental challenge to, you know, what has been, I think, a very successful and wise institution of, you know, the same punishment for the same crime. You're equally culpable, and it's regardless of the, you know, the genetic and environmental influences that led you to be, that led you to commit that crime.
Interesting. Yeah, I think that once we start talking about different sentencing for males and females, different sentencing for people addicted to drugs versus those who aren't, It starts getting the libertarian free will by subtraction theory starts getting really uncomfortable, and I don't know if I want that criminal justice system. I don't want it to take my Y chromosome into consideration, but even if I get off more leniently for the bank robbery.
Yep. I will say on the drug addiction front is a quirky one, and even some compatibilist philosophers do entertain the prospect that you have diminished responsibility if you have become seriously addicted to a drug.
I'm not surprised. I can see that argument.
If you're enjoying this conversation, please take a moment to like this video and subscribe to our channel. It really helps us reach more people who are interested in the science of IQ and human intelligence. Additionally, our team has developed the first professional, purely online IQ test called the Riot IQ test. You can try our IQ test through the link in the description, or visit Riot IQ to take the test and learn more about your own intelligence and cognitive profile. Now, back to the episode.
I want to shift to an argument I've seen from a behavioral geneticist that I do respect a lot. You've mentioned her name before, Paige Harden. She makes the argument in her book, The Genetic Lottery, that it's all just luck. The genes, the background environment, the shared environment, the unique unshared environment. She says it's all luck. Therefore, no one deserves their station in life. And so because of that, we should favor policies that distribute prosperity from the lucky to the unlucky. Why are you critical of that argument?
Yeah, it's like broadly what you say, that this is a more coherent argument than the idea that the non-shared environment is an escape hatch for free will, that we're not responsible for these, the causes of human differences, that we can't, you know, we can't identify this each specific one. So yeah, we're getting closer to the free will skeptics notion that causation swallows everything, that luck swallows everything, and there's no room for human responsibility. So you know, that's how it looks at first glance. But if you know, on closer examination, you know, this view still requires that there's some sliver of uncaused human action, that luck, you know, luck doesn't quite swallow everything, causation doesn't quite swallow everything, because there's this idea that we have a responsibility for making everyone equal. You know, if everything is down to luck, yes, we can say, you know, rich people are lucky to be rich and they don't deserve their riches, and poor people are unlucky to be poor and they don't deserve to be poor. But if you've extinguished the entire idea of desert, you can't say that poor people deserve the stuff of rich people either. So to make some appeal, you know, if you've completely destroyed the concept of moral responsibility, everything is luck, everything is causation. We can't control any. No one is responsible themselves. You know, everything is caused by the past. Then you've erased the whole basis from which you can say anyone has any individual responsibility or collective responsibility to change that. So as soon as you use incompatibilism to argue for egalitarianism, you have to step out of incompatibilism. You know, you have to be an incomplete incompatibilist. You have to move from being a free will skeptic to being to some extent, a free will by subtraction libertarian incompatibilist. You've just stolen a little sliver enough
enough to justify these policies that we want. Yeah. Though it makes sense. As I was saying, I didn't think about it that way, because if it's all luck and the rich don't deserve what they have, the poor don't deserve what they have, well, then neither do the poor deserve what the rich have either.
Exactly.
Yeah. So if you want to start redistributing, you better find a way to identify why anyone deserves anything at all.
Yeah.
So I didn't realize that perspective paints itself into a corner. That's actually probably a little bit funny when you think about it long enough.
Yeah, but you know, it's interesting. Like, you know, Hardin does actually go through all of these other things that mean the non-shared environment substantially can be attributed to things that we can't be held responsible for. She accepts that, you know, stochastic random developmental variation that makes identical twins different from each other will show up as non-shared environmental variants, and it could be most of the non-shared environmental variants. So what she says is, at best, the non-shared environment is a measure of free will, but you know, there could be this unknown amount that you have to subtract it. So she's still kind of hedging her bets. She's not fully gone. You know, she's not fully gone the free will skeptics route. She's trying to hedge her bets. And the funny thing is, you know, her kind of, you know, one of her philosophical inspirations, the political philosopher John Rawls, he also maintained this ambivalence about whether responsibility exists. He invokes the idea that, you know, genetic and environmental, this incompatibilist idea, that genetic environmental causation means we don't deserve, you know, our advantages and disadvantages. But he slips outside of that incompatibilist framing to suggest that we should try and make society as equal as we can while we can still all prosper.
Well, then instead of an explicit redistribution of wealth or opportunities or whatever, why can't we just recognize luck in all these things, environment, genes, and just adjust society so that it rewards a wider array of genetic and environmental backgrounds that people can have?
Yeah, I'm a classical liberal, and whenever I hear words like a just society or a arranged society, my hackles kind of go up. There's a famous quote from Adam Smith, where he says, you know, the man of system thinks, you know, I'm going to paraphrase, thinks he can arrange society as easily as someone can move pieces of the pieces around a chessboard. And I guess my question is always like, who gets to do the adjusting and arranging, and on what principles? Who decides how much people should be rewarded or remunerated for different things? In a free market society, in a functioning free market society, people reward things both, not just a free market society, just in a free society in general. You remunerate things how you feel, as much as you feel they deserve. You pay what you're willing to pay, but also in what you value, you spontaneously value things as much as you value them non-financially. This idea that you need to value someone stacking shelves in the supermarket more, and you need to pay them more than you would otherwise choose to, than people collectively with their own preferences, different preferences and decisions would lead to, that that is you're imposing a concept of a value that isn't emerging spontaneously.
We see this in the U.S. often. Oh, well, so-and-so sports star gets $80 million a year to hit a baseball or pass a football. And the teacher at the elementary school gets paid $50,000 a year. Is she really doing something that's that much less valuable than what the sports star does? I see the, it's unfair argument. But you're right. If someone's willing to pay that sports star $80 million and it's their money, who am I to argue, and why should I force them to start valuing teachers more? And on what basis, what philosophical basis do I get that power to decide how that money's redistributed, or that value, that worth is redistributed? So I see it. It becomes a question of, okay, well, who appoints the decision makers for this? And I'm not sure in a democratic society that we want a wise council of people making such sweeping decisions.
Yeah. And I don't have any problem with people going around saying, for example, ballet dancers and contemporary dancers are fantastic. And really, shouldn't we be paying more and seeing more performances of people doing this thing, and going around and trying to persuade people, maybe you should value these things more than you do? And people going, maybe you're right.
Persuading's different than readjusting society, though.
Yeah, and I actually think this is one of the really dangerous ideas that comes up in the genetic lottery. Just following its logic through to its conclusion, that it kind of hitches itself to this equity concept of that we should have a kind of genetic and environmental affirmative action program where your station in life and some of the professional opportunities that you have, you should get a leg up if you have measured genetic disadvantages compared to other people. And I think this idea is much more dangerous than the financial than the redistribution argument that you just discussion that you just brought up. When you're actually moving people into positions that they are actually less able to do, you're going to have planes falling out of the sky. You're going to have people dying on the operating table. And Hardin kind of hedges her bets and says, for these highly salient, high risk, high skilled jobs, obviously you want a highly skilled surgeon, obviously you want a highly skilled pilot, but it's not just in those highly skilled, highly salient jobs. If you are not matching professional opportunities and professional positions to actual skills, actual abilities, and you're trying to make some kind of cosmic adjustment, that is going to cause havoc up and down society in all of these, unforeseeable, but very bad ways.
And that makes sense. It's not just about the high skill jobs. I used to work for the U.S. military, and they expend a lot of effort to try to match up people based on their aptitudes with literally hundreds of jobs they have to fill. And, you know, for some of them, it's pretty obvious, you know, physicians, engineers, we'll make sure the people are competent there. But even in what might be called semi-skilled or unskilled jobs, like police officer, you know, the U.S. military has its own military police force. You know, I want someone very competent in that, or someone driving a tank, or even someone preparing food for the soldiers at the base. I want the food to be nutritious and edible. You don't think of a cook being a high-skilled job, but by golly, the U.S. military has a minimum IQ for its cooks, and they have to also reach certain thresholds on certain aptitudes to be able to have that job. And they didn't just pick this at random. They didn't pick these minimums at random. There's been a lot of research going into what the minimums should be and what aptitudes matter for every single one of these jobs they have to fill. And so you're right. It's one thing to say, you know, oh, it's only the doctors and the engineers where this matters. But in reality, no, it matters everywhere. Just ask the U.S. military. All right, I want to ask one last question because we have a hard stop coming up. What's been the reaction to the series of articles that you've published about these issues?
Yeah, I've had some good reactions so far. I posted this on social media, on Twitter X, as it's sometimes called. And it got to, you know, I got some pretty good traction there. I had some big accounts. Steven Pinker retweeted it.
Oh, wow.
A few other big accounts tweeted it. So it kind of did the rounds through in social media, which is great. I also have, you know, bilaterally sent it to a bunch of scientists that I deeply admire, and scientists and scholars that I deeply admire, and some of whom I've never met before. And I've been very flattered by the fact that it's a long piece, as we've discussed, and I've been flattered that they've just read the whole thing, which they've given me clear evidence that they have, and two, that, you know, so I've had some really favorable responses from some of these folks that are pretty important figures for me. So that's great. That's been very encouraging. You know, maybe they're just being polite, but even the fact that they've read it is fantastic as far as I'm concerned. You know, one thing I do get the sense, and we've touched on this already, is, you know, it's a long piece. And I think the length has been putting a lot of people off who I think will really enjoy it. And I know that because some of my friends haven't read it. You know, so friends who have been, you know, who I made partly because they reached out to me after other pieces I've written that touch on similar themes. So, you know, as mentioned earlier, I think, you know, don't be intimidated by it. You know, if you want to get stuck into it, just take one bite at a time. It's got a 2-page executive summary at the start, which gives you a sense of what you're going to get into. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think it touches on lots of, you know, lots of different themes that people will find interesting.
Oh yeah, we've only scratched the surface. We didn't talk about, for example, control versus causation. There's a section in there. We didn't dive through all the different forms of the arguments about libertarianism and free will by subtraction, etc. But yeah, I hope that the audience is not put off by the length or the fact that it's chopped up into 3 articles, because if I could show my tablet again, this is part 2. I mean, I've highlighted an embarrassing amount of stuff. Yes, I say, oh, that's a good insight. That's new. I mean, every page is just, well, this is the references at the end. Every page of actual text is littered with highlights, insights, things that I thought were interesting, we didn't even reach 10% of this. And so I do hope people check it out. Once again, the article is called Behavioral Genetics and Human Agency: How Selectively Deterministic Theories of Free Will Drive Unwarranted Opposition to Behavioral Genetic Research and Undermine Our Moral and Legal Conventions. It was published in Twin Research and Human Genetics. I invite our audience to check it out. Don't let the length put you off. It's well worth the time and the investment and the attention you can give it. And I thank you, Damien, for joining us for this episode.
Great. Thanks for having me on, Russell.
If you enjoyed this episode, please also check out our discussion with Karen Rambo-Hernandez about the education system and how it deals with variability. Also, please check out our episode with Dr. Jonathan Anomaly and his discussion about embryo selection, which touches on a lot of these issues of choice and determinism and genetics. And so please do check those out. Also, like and subscribe to find more episodes from the podcast and visit riotiq.com.